From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The Republican Party, that's President Donald Trump's party, held its convention in an unconventional way, much as the Democrats did the previous week. The convention was mostly a TV show, gathering the usual way, tens of thousands of party members in a huge auditorium or sports arena. Impossible, unsafe during the coronavirus pandemic. We'll discuss what the Republicans were emphasizing and the state of the big political contest, Mr. Trump versus former Vice President Joe Biden, with Election Day, November 3rd, only 2 months away. There was another shooting of an unarmed black man by a white police officer seen on mobile phone video, this time in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And after that, trouble in the streets included somebody apparently thinking he's the friend of police, shooting and killing two protesters. And professional athletes, including NBA basketball stars, canceled their games to direct attention to how police often mistreat black people. And we'll discuss more major events as time permits, but let's turn to our panel. Both of you work for British publications, but you know America very well. Emily Tamkin, Republicans were very proud of their party convention. President Trump put in an appearance on every one of the four nights, including his Thursday night speech accepting his party's nomination. Now, Emily, how were the Republicans trying to be different than the Democrats and the show they put on the week before?
I think they were trying to be different in that there was more audience interaction, right? Like during Melania Trump's speech and Vice President Mike Pence's speech, there were people in the audience to applaud. But to me, the main difference was that usually conventions are about the candidate, but also about the party more broadly and the vision that party is laying out for America. I think here what we really saw, it was about Trump, right? They didn't even have a platform, just a resolution saying they would support Trump's agenda. So it was either about Trump and why he's good or offering twisted facts, and in some cases just straight out lies, that created a version of our reality right now that was more preferable to Trump, one in which the pandemic was a smashing success and in which the violence in the cities is a reflection on Joe Biden and not Trump. I thought the focus on this one figure, to me, was what distinguished it from not just from the DNC, but from really every convention that we've seen so far.
Yeah, even when parties have the incumbent president in office, it usually is a party. This one was totally up to the president, other members of the Trump family. And as for the picture they were painting of the Democratic Party, the Republicans kept saying that the Democrats would drag this country toward socialism and violence in the streets. And Republicans also kept mentioning their faith in God and American values. So Josh Glancy, as you write for the British newspaper, the Sunday Times, I wonder whether your article about all this is going to be, well, snarky. Sometimes foreign reporters are a little cynical about American flags everywhere and all those so-called patriotic values.
It's certainly true that the pomp and circumstance of the occasion can be a little grating, and there's a lot of trite cliches about the American dream and more perfect unions and the work of this great nation. But I thought both parties set out their stall pretty much as expected. You know, the Democrats sought to sort of present Joe Biden to the nation as a kind of savior, as a gentleman, as a decent man who will bring us towards hope and light. And the Republicans painted a much more mixed picture. They attacked the Democrats on the culture war front, law and order in the cities, but they also sought to portray themselves as a little softer, a little more multicultural. They put a lot of their people of color representatives up front, and they sought to soften the image of Donald Trump somewhat, mainly by putting his family members out there, which some people found questionable, but others, you know, appreciate having his daughters and his daughter-in-laws and his sons all sort of talking together. As a family, people buy into the Trump family brand. So, yeah, it was a sort of mixed bag on both fronts, really.
And another tactic that was questioned by many Trump critics was his use of government buildings, especially his official residence, the White House. It's very unusual for an American president to address his party convention from the White House, but that's where his big Thursday speech was. His wife, Melania Trump, spoke from the White House Rose Garden. And also part of the convention, he took part in the swearing in of new U.S. citizens, immigrants from foreign nations, and the president even pardoned a former prison inmate. Those White House events seen as part of the convention. Now, Emily Tamkin, the White House is defending this mixture between government work and partisan politics. I know there are even legal questions about it, Emily.
I would note that the immigrants who were involved in the naturalization ceremony reportedly were not told that they were going to be taking part in this convention. I would also note that in the United States, we have something called the Hatch Act, which says that members of the executive branch, save for the president and the vice president, cannot take part in certain political activities. Trump is exempt from this, but Chad Wolf, the acting Department of Homeland Security secretary, who was also in this in a political event, it's not just about the breaking of norms, it's also about the breaking of laws. Whether anybody does anything about that is another question. Right. And there are also reports that White House officials are saying, well, the Hatch Act, let me know when somebody's arrested. And that's not to say that it's not effective. It can be very effective, which is why there is an act to prevent taxpayer funded government offices, et cetera, from being used for political stunts. So we also had some possible ethics and maybe legal violations as part of this convention as well.
Well, another example would be a speech to the Republican convention pre-recorded by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. And usually America's chief diplomat stays away from his or her party's convention because it's supposed to be a non-political role, Secretary of State. Pompeo was speaking from Jerusalem while on an official trip to Israel and other countries. Josh Glancy, Democrats are calling that also outrageous.
Yes, it's worth noting that plenty of other cabinet secretaries have appeared at conventions in the past, including Democratic conventions. So this isn't wholly without precedent. Usually the Secretary of State is considered a kind of lofty chief diplomat who doesn't sully themselves with such things. But, you know, the idea that politics stops at the water's edge has been eroding for a while. This was another example of that. You know, Pompeo's speech was, you know, had a lot of symbolism to it. It was done in Jerusalem with the backdrop of the old city. It was a message to Trump's large evangelical support, a reminder that, you know, they've moved the embassy to Jerusalem, that they've just signed a peace deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. And Pompeo was there to shore that up and promote it. You know, yes, it was something of a norm violation, but Pompeo was very careful to say, he didn't say his job title. He said, I'm the father of, you know, and husband. It was a sort of way of getting round the Hatch Act, supposedly. So yes, a norm violation, but also quite a powerful piece of symbolism from the Secretary of State. And I don't think he's going to be in an orange jumpsuit for it anytime soon.
Well, one thing that happens, and indeed no arrests are expected, is that Republicans say, at least privately, that there may have been a technical violation, maybe a violation of law, certainly of past practice, but only liberals are going to be angry about it. And then we think about the content of the speech, and I think we'll want to analyze that a little bit. Secretary of State Pompeo was boasting about foreign policy successes since President Trump came into office at the start of 2017. An example, seeing no long-range missile tests or nuclear explosions by North Korea. Also during the convention, by the way, we heard a claim that President Trump charmed the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, though they're known to have, well, a very bad relationship, to be frank. Emily, what did you think of Pompeo's claims?
North Korea, look, I think that it's fair to say that Trump walked back from fire and fury and tried to have these negotiations and that we've tried to take a more peaceful path with North Korea. He could have said that, but, you know, there are reports from earlier this month that North Korea has probably developed nuclear devices to fit ballistic missiles per the UN. Again, there's a way to present this that's factual and grounded in reality. I'm just not sure that that was the way in which the Secretary of State laid it out.
Of course, this is part of a political campaign. Josh, what remarks would you make there? I mean, because whether it's about foreign policy, which is never that big in U.S. politics, or what's been happening in the U.S., the economy supposedly was great, and then the so-called China virus, as the White House likes to put it, struck the U.S. economy, but Trump can rebuild. When it comes to the promises of a political convention, I don't know if anybody really holds the party to it.
Yeah, primarily it's a piece of political theatre, but it's also a marking point to show us that we are really in the campaign proper now. And I think for a lot of Americans who don't necessarily tune in to the political horse race up until now, this is a marker in the sand saying, you know, this is the real campaign now. I thought the Republicans, they've got a point in a way that they're trying to say that, you know, actually the economy was going quite well, at least for most people, until the pandemic hit. So Trump's real hope at this point is that the pandemic dwindles somewhat and the numbers are coming down a little bit, and that the economy starts to pick up and the employment numbers rise between now and November, so that come election day, he can say, well, look, we've had a rough year. No one would deny that. But we're back on the up and up. And I'm the guy to take us back to where we were in January of 2020, when things were somewhat better. So that's going to be their argument. And that's probably Trump's best shot at winning in November.
A notable claim by President Trump himself is that if the Democrats come into power as a result of November's election, then the U.S. economy will fall apart. And again, many of the Republicans at the convention were saying America would move toward socialism. Emily Tamkin, the Democrats, by contrast, were stressing issues such as social justice and how people of color are treated in this country. You know, Republicans say the Democrats were negative, 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 and that during a COVID pandemic, American voters probably want to hear something more hopeful. What's your take?
I think that any American who's actually watching these conventions, and the numbers are down from last year.
Would you say 4 years ago, so kind?
Yes, exactly. So fewer Americans are watching the conventions now than they were 4 years ago. And I think that people who tuned in probably tuned in with pre-existing biases. So if you believe that the Obama economy was in fact good and the recession here in the United States actually started in February prior to the pandemic. But I think if you are already voting for the Democrats, you are probably going to fixate on that second point, right? And how Trump destroyed the Obama economy. And if you are supporting Trump, you think that Trump saved the economy. And look how, as Josh said, look how good we had it in January 2020. So, you know, the tone of the Democratic convention, I guess, could be construed as bleak because we have almost 180,000 Americans dead from this pandemic, and there's police brutality, and there's et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know that the tone of one or the other is going to convince anyone who didn't tune in with their mind about what the tone of the country is already made up, if that makes sense.
This year, some folks say that hardly anything makes sense. But on the other hand, another phrase going around America is, it is what it is. In other words, we are here with a lot of challenges to the United States. Both political parties are suggesting they have the answer. And we clearly know who the candidates are. Before we take a little break, let me note that national opinion polls for many weeks have indicated that Joe Biden, the Democrat, is ahead of Donald Trump, perhaps by around 10 percentage points. And we wonder if that may change because of the two political conventions. Each party sometimes gets a bounce from its political convention. We'll talk more about politics and other issues when we continue.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New Statesman. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator, Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
We were just noting that in the opinion polls leading up to the two political party conventions here in the United States, Donald Trump actually was trailing his challenger, the Democrat Joe Biden, sometimes by around 10 percentage points. But a lot can change between now and November 3rd, Election Day. And the American system involves 50 separate elections in the 50 states. If you win even a tiny majority, say in the state of Ohio, you get all the electoral votes from that state. So 4 years ago, the Democrat Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. But he put together the states with their electoral votes that brought him victory. So Josh and Emily, I'm hearing that the Democrats vow not to make that mistake again, to focus on states where Trump was the winner by a tiny margin like Wisconsin and Michigan. But Josh, with COVID-19 limiting any public rallies, we don't know how much the candidates will be traveling. Biden especially seems reluctant. What will this campaign look like?
Well, Biden is, yeah, 77-year-old man. Also, the Democratic Party have been pretty clear that part of their political strategy is the pandemic. You know, they obviously want to take it very seriously, but they also want to emphasize that Donald Trump has not taken it seriously enough. So their campaign is happening almost exclusively virtually. They're not really knocking on doors. Biden's not traveling outside of his hometown of Wilmington, Delaware much. They're really relying on the fact that people are still going to be in their homes come November and that they can reach them virtually. The Trump campaign is being a little bit more outward facing in terms of they are knocking on doors. You've had these Trump boat rallies, these flotillas going up and down lakes and rivers. And I wouldn't be surprised if the president tries to hold some in-person rallies in the fall, depending on where the pandemic is. There is a contrast in the two campaigns. Although Biden's ahead, things are tightening up, particularly in the battleground states that you mentioned, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Some of the polling is still positive for Biden, but it's not what it was in June and July. And two horse races have a tendency to tighten coming down the stretch. So I think there'll be a few nerves jangling in the Biden camp as we head into the fall.
Emily, what's your view of what seemed evident to me that President Trump and his vice president, Mike Pence, are willing to be close to crowds? You know, maybe not exactly shaking hands and not embracing, but still willing to be close. And the White House says that the president is frequently tested and he hasn't had COVID-19. And people who get close to the president apparently are tested. Does all this make President Trump look kind of stronger because he's willing to meet people?
I personally don't think so, but I'm sure that there are people in this vast country of ours who do, in the same way that there were people who seized on the fact that Biden rode a bicycle and said, oh, he's the strong one. I was just picking up on something that Josh said. I actually wrote about this week. You know, the polls have Biden ahead, but if you look at different other numbers, for example, that according to one poll, 50% of white voters today would vote for Donald Trump, or that more Midwestern voters would vote for Trump than they would Biden if the election were held today. That's according to the Hill-Harris-X poll. I think you can see that there are people who will support this president no matter what is happening in the country around them, no matter what he says or does. And particularly if the pandemic is not as bad as it was, or if we've just acclimated to this new reality, Trump absolutely has a path to victory. And to your point, Dan, I think that him doing rallies and going out and shaking hands is part of them presenting that this is normal, right? That, look, the pandemic's not that bad. It's not that devastating. Here the president is with his fans.
And his fans aren't wearing masks on their faces all that often, whereas Joe Biden and Democrats are making a point of wearing masks, telling Americans to be more cautious, and claiming that they, the Democrats, are more responsible. A lot of people think that the three face-to-face debates between President Trump and Biden may be decisive in convincing Americans who aren't sure whom they will support, choosing one man or the other. The first debate will be September 29th. But looking ahead, what about the notion we're not likely to really have the election result at the end of Election Day, November 3rd, that so many Americans will vote by mailing in their ballots, mainly because they're concerned by the COVID-19 virus. They don't want to go out. They don't want to stand in a line ready to cast their ballot, but instead we'll mail it in. And then one party or the other might challenge the official count and we'll have lawsuits. Josh Glancy, President Trump has even suggested he might not accept the results because all of this is tied in with the post office and what looks like a crisis at the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah, there's certainly a potential very serious, even constitutional crisis brewing if we see some kind of very close election, a bit like 2000 between George W. Bush and Al Gore. And if it comes down to one state and one county and there's some dispute over how the ballots were counted there, then I think things could get pretty feisty. The postal office stuff is being politicized by both sides. Trump has spoken quite intemperately about the post office and his mistrust of mail-in voting. On the Democratic side, there's been a little bit of conspiracy mongering over the postal process being jeopardized. But it does seem like there's a bit of a problem. The Postal Service has been undergoing some cost-cutting reforms. It's terribly in debt. And Louis DeJoy, who's the Postmaster General, has been implementing these cost-cutting reforms. It's probably not a great time to do them, even if they didn't affect the process, which they may. It's a very bad optic, given he's a Trump supporter and donor. they've been cutting some sort of high-speed processing machines. They've been taking away some of those blue postal boxes. Those reforms have now been paused until after the election. But as Louis DeJoy told a committee this week, he's not going to seek to undo the changes that have already been made. Again, if this isn't a close election, we'll completely forget we were having this discussion. However, if it is very close, then these issues will be picked over with a fine-tooth comb, and no doubt both sides will find a reason to complain or dispute the other side's findings. So there are the seeds of a real crisis in place at the moment.
DeJoy told Congress that he's an experienced transport executive and he was striving for efficiency. Now, he did say he'll hold off on any further changes, and he expressed confidence that the Postal Service can handle all the mail-in ballots. Now, Emily Tamkin, especially when he said he was not biased in his business decisions, was DeJoy convincing?
Let us give Mr. DeJoy the benefit of the doubt and say that he's not biased and he's really just trying to undo some of the financial damage that Congress has wrought by changing the post office's fiduciary responsibilities back in 2006. As Josh says, the fact that he chose before the election to, for example, remove mail sorting machines, it hurts the confidence of voters, including, by the way, I would think, of Republican voters who tend to vote by mail more than Democrats do, perhaps not in this pandemic election, but typically hurts their trust in the mail and the postal service in this election. I guess the only point on which I disagree with everything that Josh just said is that I think that regardless of what happens, maybe we'll try to forget, but I don't think there's any undoing the fact that we had people ahead of the election, including the president, starting to sow seeds of doubt about its legitimacy. The only thing that protects the legitimacy of American elections is that people believe in it and buy into it. And you already have people, again, on both sides, not doing that.
Americans were shocked when yet another unarmed Black American was shot dead by a white police officer. Jacob Blake, age 29, was very severely wounded, shot 7 times in the back. That was in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Protests erupted, demanding that the police officer who fired the shots and some of his colleagues be fired and charged with crimes. And during a protest in Kenosha, someone, allegedly a 17-year-old who loved police, opened fire and killed 2 people identified as demonstrators. Now, Josh Glancy, this got worldwide attention.
Watching the footage of those 7 bullets being put into Jacob Blake's back at point-blank range is quite a sort of galling and a really quite astonishing thing to see. And unfortunately, it's playing out now according to this script where there's understandable protests on the streets. Unfortunately, there's also some violence, some looting, some rioting. And now you have armed white vigilantes carrying AR-15 rifles and other serious weaponry seeking to combat some of the violence. But, you know, obviously you turn up to that kind of situation armed. These people aren't trained about, you know, when and how to use their guns. And this young man, allegedly Kyle Rittenhouse, 17-year-old, allegedly opened fire and killed 2 people, and a further person was wounded. So it's pretty febrile stuff, the specter of a kind of racial violence on the streets of America, and it'll have political ramifications. Kenosha is in Wisconsin, a swing state, as you mentioned earlier, but it's also just hard to see how these situations get resolved. This could be with us for a very long time.
Well, as the NBA, the basketball league, had its championship playoffs, several teams refused to play as their protest. And that became kind of the thing in professional sports. Athletes want Americans to pay more attention to what police are doing to African Americans. Racial strife, a big issue, not just, of course, in the sports world. The protests are not going away, Emily.
Yeah, I think on the point of sports generally, and the NBA specifically, as Fred VanVleet, who's a player on the Toronto Raptors, said, are we just here to have Black Lives Matter painted on the side of the court and to wear like peace and justice on our jerseys, or does this mean something? And I think what these athletes are trying to do, you know, these athletes who, many of whom were and are Black men and women before they were basketball players or baseball players or whatever, it's not just about bringing attention to it. It's about saying we need to see change. You know, there's the quote, sports is a reward for a functioning society. When you have the Milwaukee Bucks in the locker room trying to get the attorney general of Wisconsin on the phone so that something is actually done, that is not a functioning society. That is people stepping into a role that they should not have to play in order to try to affect some change for communities, either of which they're a part or to which they're expressing solidarity.
And as the United States headed into the weekend, there was another challenge. Hurricane Laura hit the Texas-Louisiana border area and moved on, and the damage is being assessed. Kind of a sad story here in the United States. That's all the time we have. Our thanks to Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for The New Statesman, author of a book about billionaire George Soros called The Influence of Soros, and Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the British newspaper The Sunday Times. This program is produced here in Washington by The Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravine.